Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. And I think what I'll do is I'm going to talk to you about what's most on my mind right now, which is my new book. This is going to be a lengthy discussion for the first time about my new book. It's called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. It comes out on December 4th. You can get an advanced copy of the book on Google. Just go Peter Breggin or just go Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. The subtitle is Understanding and Overcoming Your Negative Emotions. How to overcome, understand and overcome guilt, shame, and anxiety. Now, I got started on this book in a very interesting and unusual way. I was working on a book about what's the matter with the biological psychiatry approach. It's going to be a critique, in particular, of biological evolutionary theories. It was going to be a critique of neuroscience, fake neuroscience, neuromania, it's been called. And I decided I didn't want to do that book. And I actually just canceled. So I don't want to do a negative book. I want to do a positive book about overcoming problems. There's been a lot of critiques out about, you know, what's the matter with the evolutionary viewpoint of human emotions, what's wrong with the neuroscientific viewpoint. But in the process, I read again and started reading again about biological evolution. And it made me think some more. My criticizing the existing formulations made me think more about what in the world do I think is going on with guilt, shame, and anxiety? Because I've been studying guilt, shame, and anxiety and actually writing various book forms about it. And I mean, just trying every way to approach it, but not a lot of it getting into my books and no final formulation. And then it suddenly struck me, look, I need to face this. It's obviously guilt, shame, and anxiety are built into our bodies. I mean, it's not just some existential thing that comes upon you when you face death at age 40 or at age 17 as an adolescent. No, think about it. The shame reaction's built right into our body, so much so that it's physiologically more or less wired. I mean, wired is too concrete. I mean, you don't have wires. I mean, nervous system is much more malleable than that and hard to understand than that. But think about it. In all cultures and all races, if you feel shame, you blush. And you may get tingling sensations. You may get other discomforts in your body that feel neurological in origin and are. So that's wired right into us. We feel shame, and we feel it in very particular circumstances that I'll go into in more detail as I present to you my concepts of guilt, shame, and anxiety. And they're going to be somewhat original because I think I actually have formulated for my new book the first comprehensive theory about this and the first biologically rooted theory. All right, so now let's look at anxiety. And again, anxiety isn't just something that occurs in response to our lives. It's built into us. Every culture, human beings feel anxiety, and animals also seem to feel anxiety. Maybe even, you know, it can be argued that there are signs of shame and guilt in chimpanzees and your family dog, but it's you know, hard to get exactly how much it's human. But anxiety, we can create anxiety in animals by confusing them in punishing ways. I don't favor those experiments. Very clear we can do that. But anxiety is wired into our bodies, leading to a release of adrenaline in the body and to a firing up of the norepinephrine in the brain and developing a fight-or-flight response that Cannon described decades ago. So anxiety is wired into the body too. Now, what about guilt? Well, guilt has physical manifestations, but they're more variable. In general, people get sluggish. They don't think as clearly. The gut can slow down. They can look like they and feel fatigued and just, you know, the body just not working right and something wrong in the brain, it feels like. So while it's not as specific, we do feel guilt, shame, and anxiety very much in our bodies. And now all cultures have these three experiences. There's some argument going on, and I'll address it briefly in the book, about whether guilt is like a derivative of shame. But, you know, as way back to the ancient ancient Roman books and the Aeneid and certainly the Hebrew Bible, you have both guilt and shame, and all modern cultures, guilt, shame, and anxiety. So, all right, why would nature build in biologically these reactions? Why would they be built in? Well, before getting to that, let me discuss what I think these reactions are doing. I think they're nature's way of, in part, of anger management. The human being, and long before we were Homo sapiens, probably going back to bipeds a million years ago or more, we have been, on the one hand, the most social creatures on Earth. The most social creatures on Earth, and the most violent creatures on Earth. Now, I've seen people try to argue that bees are more social than we are, or dolphins are more social than we are. But, you look at it with any clarity, and we are clearly the most social creatures on Earth. And hardly anybody argues about whether we're the most violent, because our history of violence is being played out continually right in front of us on the television and the radio and everything we read throughout the world. And it varies from these cataclysmic atrocities we carry out on a intercultural and intersocial and interreligious level, international level, and then just violence on our streets at home and violence in our homes, domestic violence and child abuse. So we are the most violent creatures and the most social creatures. Well, why did we develop this way? Well, if you go back half a million years, you'll find evidence that human beings would band together to kill and slaughter creatures larger, much larger than today's elephants, elephant-like giant creatures. Well, how in the world did we do that? We did it with pointed sticks. There's not even evidence we had hatchets or spears, tipped spears. So for a creature to develop evolutionarily to be so violent and willful and aggressive, and I lump those together knowing there are differences, but thinking about them as one concept for our discussion purposes, violence, willfulness, aggression, we lump all those together, and we see that them coming together in our ability to attack a giant animal, kill it. On the other hand, we have to be very social to do that. We have to band together. We have to cooperate. We have to signal direction and signal who's going to do what. And we have to be brave, and we have to want to bring back meat at all costs, almost, back to our infirm, our wives, our children, and maybe whoever's guarding camp. So from early on, so violent and so social. Some evolutionary biologists talk about us as the epitome of the carnivore, even though we're omnivorous, that we're the top of the carnivore chain. And we probably got that way soon after, if not before, coming out of Africa into Europe. Okay, well, how in the world does a creature that is the most violent and the most social ever on Earth manage to raise a family without killing off its wives and the wives or the women killing off the children or the peer groups turning on each other? How do you have a family? How do you have a small unit of society living in a cave or living in huts, then later living in clans and tribes. How do you have that? Well, been known for a long time. Darwin talked about it, that we developed some sort of internal morality that was reflexive and primitive, not high level, that prevents us from unleashing our violence in our intimate social lives. Doesn't work very well, as we can see from the today, from the child abuse statistics, and it didn't work that well, and even in some primitive cultures, but it works pretty well compared to how we unleash violence on strangers, which we do with enormous frequency and violence and lack of restraint. So what happened? Well, natural selection would begin to favor, long before we were Homo sapiens, way back when we're bipeds of various kinds, whether it's Neanderthals or Homo habilis, we're developing inhibitions on ourselves. Inhibitions in the form of terrible, dreadful feelings, if we unleash our willfulness, our assertiveness, our aggression, and our violence on those in our intimate loving circles. Because we were a loving creature way, way back. And we see love in our in animals, our domestic dogs. We see love between chimpanzees. But we're the most loving animal. And in our loving relationships, natural selection was going to favor those of us with built-in inhibitions, instinctually, biologically built in, that could be elicited early in our lives to prevent us from fully expressing our willfulness, our aggression, our violence toward others. One form of that is shame, one form of that is guilt, and one form of that is anxiety. And that's a theory I call the theory of negative legacy emotions. These emotions are negative and they are inhibitory. They're negative in that they're very primitive. They're so primitive they can be passed on genetically and elicited in childhood before we can even reason. They're negative legacy emotions. And they are nature's anger management. Nature's anger management. And by anger, I mean that panoply of assertiveness, certainly extreme assertiveness and willfulness and anger and the desire to dominate and control other human beings. So when we feel that as a little child, in the book I write, in the book Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, I write about the little child who's whittling on his stick a couple of hundred thousand years ago, and he admires his daddy so much, who's just brought home huge pieces of steak that they're cooking over the fire, and dad's done it with his big pointed stick and the cooperation of a number of the clan members, some of whom may have been injured that day. And he looks at his little brother and he thinks, oh, wow, I could practice hunting on him. But he doesn't. Why? Because he's overcome with either guilt, shame, or anxiety, depending on his surroundings, depending on his upbringings, depending on whether his dad's looking at him at the time and how he's been treated. But one of those three emotions are going to overcome him at the thought of creeping up on his little brother. It may be guilt, that is, I'm being big and bad and bigger and badder. Dad is going to punish me, a built-in guilt reaction. Could be shame, that he'll be humiliated for doing something so stupid and outside the clan and outside the family and unacceptable. And besides, he's stupid to think he could ever be a hunter. It may be a shame reaction that disempowers him and makes him feel unable to act. Or it may be anxiety, and anxiety just overwhelms us so that we become raw helpless and we can't act. Now, just looking more conceptually for a minute at this then, guilt, this is an old conceptualization that's part of the newer negative legacy emotion theory. Guilt, we turn the anger in. In shame, we tend to turn the anger out, but we don't express it. We feel too humiliated, too insignificant. We don't express it out unless it just overwhelmingly breaks us up and we retaliate. And in anxiety, the anger is completely dispersed. We don't even feel anger toward anything. We just feel helpless. We may blame the world or blame life or how tough life is, but we don't blame a person and we don't blame ourselves specifically. But either of these three things eventually break down because they're imperfect. They're built in before reason. They're not necessarily based on any ethical rules. They're built in biologically. So we can get so anxious that eventually we get irritable and anxious, angry. We can get so guilt-ridden that eventually we blame somebody for making us feel guilty. Or most likely the weakest anger management mechanism is the shame, where we can end up feeling just vengeful to the people we see making us ashamed. So these are imperfect mechanisms, and we have to accept that, look at that, continue to try to understand this general formulation of the negative legacy emotions that are so primitive. They are so primitive. They're so prehistoric. And they're prehistoric not just in being from our childhood, from biological evolution. They're prehistoric because we can't even remember mostly the origins of them. Even people with good memories going back in childhood are not likely to remember some of the worst experiences that elicited, amplified, and redirected or worsened our guilt, shame, and anxiety. So they're literally prehistoric. So what does that mean? It means that all of us, every human being, has a legacy of one degree or another built in by evolution to control our willfulness, our assertion, and our aggression, a legacy of guilt, shame, and anxiety. Now, can guilt, shame, and anxiety serve some good purposes? I mean, that's a really good question. And I'm going to reserve answering that till we come back after the break. And our break won't be for a few minutes yet. When I come back, I'm going to answer questions like, well, do guilt, shame, and anxiety serve any purpose? And then after that, I'm going to go into discussing with you, how do we overcome guilt, shame, and anxiety? How do we have free will? And I'm also going to talk to you about Charles Darwin, because Darwin has been so misrepresented by the academicians, so misrepresented by so-called modern scientists of evolution, totally misrepresented. Darwin, you're going to discover in the next half hour, was not a Darwinian at all. He had very different ideas about human nature and about overcoming guilt, shame, and anxiety. And again, the book is going to be coming out December 4th. You can order it in advance right now before you forget. You can order it on Amazon.com. And I think you're going to find it's a remarkable book, that it really relooks at the whole issue of guilt, shame, and anxiety, their origin and their function. And one of the ways that we see guilt, shame, and anxiety and how it works most obviously and grossly is when we as therapists deal with, or police officers or other concerned citizens deal with, people who have been horribly abused, either terribly sexually abused in childhood or have been abused in adulthood. Because what happens always in a childhood is the guilt, shame, and anxiety are turned on the self. The individual doesn't say, oh, my mother or the neighbor or my big brother or sister was shameful in the way they abused me. Don't say that they were guilty for what they did. They themselves experience feeling guilty about themselves, ashamed of themselves, and anxious about their lives. This is a real illustration of a point that I'm going to look at in a couple of more minutes after the break, which is the question of, do guilt, shame, and anxiety serve any useful purpose as we grow up and become adults, and how do we overcome them? So we'll take a minute now. I'm going to take a breath and have a glass of water and save my voice a little bit and come back and tell you more about guilt, shame, and anxiety. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and I'm having a really good time. I'm actually just talking for an hour. You know, I travel all over the country and talk for an hour and a half with folks. I talked to 600 people a few weeks ago in Kearney, Nebraska. I was in Des Moines, Iowa. That was at the University in Kearney. I was at Des Moines, Iowa, talking to five or six groups over 2 days at a rehab center that I talked about last week. But I haven't do that much on my own show. For some reason, I can't even tell you exactly why, I like to interview people on my own show. But I'm enjoying this because I'm telling you a little ahead of time, because my guest didn't show. We had some problem. It's the first time, by the way, that I've had that, where there was a technical problem or he forgot. I'm not sure whether he had a technical problem on his end. But I'm talking about today about my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. It's available on Amazon.com now. It will be physically available. You can buy it now, physically available on December 4th. And the book is in three parts. The first part is understanding our negative legacy emotions. It's about understanding guilt, shame, and anxiety. And the nature of guilt, shame, and anxiety is such that they're intolerable to people. So over time, what often happens is that people develop chronic anger or they go numb. And so the issue of overcoming guilt, shame, and anxiety is also related to its results of chronic anger and chronic feelings of numbness. And numbness is a feeling, though hard to describe, and it's a very, very uncomfortable feeling that people don't want to stay in. Now, there's a common denominator, and this is, again, a part of the concept of negative legacy emotions that tries to tie together guilt, shame, and anxiety. And again, I don't know another theory that actually really works at tying them together. For example, Adler talks mostly about shame, Freud about guilt and anxiety, and so on. The existentialists about anxiety. This theory says that they all serve a similar function. They may do other things in our lives, but they serve a similar evolutionary function. And beneath them is a common denominator of helplessness. So when you're feeling really, really guilty and you can't get out of bed and face life, for example, because you feel your choices are so painful, you feel so bad about yourself, or you're feeling suicidal, guilt, ultimately, those are feelings of overwhelming helplessness. Now, similarly, if you're feeling so shameful that you're insignificant, you're meaningless, and people also will not want to get out of bed and face the day because they feel like they're just going to be humiliated again and made to feel worthless, made to feel different, made to feel they don't belong. That, too, is an overwhelming feeling of helplessness. And then finally, of course, anxiety is the rawest direct experience of helpless feelings. And this is not objective. It's not like objectively you're helpless, like you can't move your arms and legs because you've had a neurological injury. It's not like objective helplessness because you're in a jail. It's emotional helplessness, a kind of giving up. It's an attitude. It is different from objective helplessness. It's also different from the concept of learned helplessness, which is more limited and has largely been used to describe the feelings of depression, but has something in common with that, except it's an underlying idea behind all of our most painful emotions, that underneath them are helplessness. And evolution inflicted that that capacity to feel helpless when in conflict with those nearest and dearest to us. So natural selection made it such that when, as children especially, we went into conflict with our parents, we have ultimately felt guilt, shame, and anxiety and became helpless in regard to asserting ourselves. Especially, of course, our violence and our aggression and our willfulness. Now, the problem is that this doesn't work very well in childhood. It makes children docile or angry or reactive. It isn't teaching them ethics, which I believe sound ethics are based on reason and empathy. Reason, principled living, and empathy. They're not built on guilt, shame, and anxiety. And why is that? Because guilt, shame, and anxiety make us helpless. So that as you grow into adulthood and you're called upon to make a difficult decision, whether you're going to sacrifice something of yourself or something in a relationship, whether you're going to take some huge risk for a good reason, and you start to feel guilty or ashamed or anxious, that's just interfering with your reasoning process, and it's also interfering with love, which is the soundest ethic, empathy and love. So you're not really in a good position to even judge what you're doing when you're overcome with guilt, shame, and anxiety. For example, if you feel guilty towards your loved one, your wife or your husband, you're not going to be loving toward them. We don't feel loving when we feel guilty. We feel self-punitive and helpless. Or if you're ashamed of your something you've done in relation to your husband, your wife, loved one, friend, you're not going to feel loving toward them again because you're feeling ashamed. You're going to pile inside yourself and say mean things to yourself. And with anxiety, if you're feeling anxious, you're certainly not going to feel loving. So these emotions, they interfere with love. They interfere with reason. They don't really advance our lives. Now, some people will respond, well, shouldn't you feel guilty? If you've hurt somebody, shouldn't the murderer feel guilty? Well, what does that mean, shouldn't you feel guilty? The fact is that most murderers are reacting to overwhelming shame. They finally have had enough of feeling helpless and impotent and weak. Like most mass murderers, most school shooters, they feel like they've been shamed once too much, and they strike back with violence. Shame's not a good control mechanism, and besides, it's not good for the individual, let alone if the individual finally unleashes. And just as violence against others is the default position we fall into and overwhelmed with shame, violence against ourselves is what we usually do when we're feeling guilty, we get suicidal. That's not good for us or for anybody else. Well, people just have trouble with this. They want to come back. I had an interesting discussion with some devout Christians. Most of you, or many of you, know I'm Jewish, but I've been influenced by the best of Christianity in our culture, which is about love one another, love God, love one another. All right. Well, I mean, Christians often carry a great load of guilt out of their churches and out of their childhoods. And yet that's not the message. If you read Christ's message, his message is, I'm taking your guilt on so that you can become free to love one another, love me, love God. I mean, that is clearly the message as best understood, I believe. Then there's a lot of other stuff that one has to deal with, both in the Bible and in church and in temple and so on. But certainly the best religious messages and the best religious leaders have not told us to feel guilty. They've ashamed or anxious. They've told us to be brave and courageous and to love. And that is definitely the message that I believe we need. But it doesn't come out of guilt and shame and anxiety. Now, some psychologists will argue with that. They'll say, well, you know, the alcoholic, I'm treating an alcoholic, and he feels ashamed of himself and guilty. And I say to him, well, of course, look how you've lived, but now you have an opportunity to overcome that. Well, that's not what I would say. I would say, hey, it's your guilt and shame that drove and anxiety that drove you into alcoholism. You were ashamed of yourself. You tried to drown it in alcohol. You felt guilty. You tried to drown in alcohol. You felt anxious. You tried to drown it in alcohol. And now you've got all that added stuff on that you've done, sure, to make you feel bad. But the whole origin of this thing is guilt, shame, and anxiety. I want you to leave it behind. And this is what I told the rehab center, what I told folks. You're not going to get anything out of feeling more guilt, shame, and anxiety. It's not going to make you more loving, more ethical, more rational. It's going to make you more helpless and resentful. Now, get over it. Let it go. It's biological in origin, built into your body. It isn't personal. It's built into everybody. It was built into us long before we were Homo sapiens, when we were just barely able to be social creatures. We were already on this trajectory of being social and aggressive at the same time, and we probably started feeling guilt 500,000 or 1,000,000 years ago, sitting around a campfire. Now, it's time to overcome the legacy, the negative legacy emotions, that's the theory, to overcome that in order to live by love, in order to live by reason. Now, how do we go about it? In my book, In Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, I talk about the three steps to emotional freedom, because that's what we're talking about, emotional freedom. Freedom to live by reason, by love, by sound principles, to be brave. Let me take you on the side about that. When I've been doing reform work since I was quite young, you know, 4 years of college. I worked in state mental hospitals. I took on the establishment. I created a unique program where we worked as individuals with individual clients or patients on the back wards and ended up showing we could get them out of the hospital. Well, it took a lot of courage to do that, and it was a bit of an emotional beating to do that. When I then began to do reform work in earnest in the early 70s, when I decided I was going to be the first psychiatrist to stand up against the establishment and say no more lobotomy, because lobotomy was coming back. And then I said, well, okay, I've been successful. I actually was successful in stopping throughout the world. I really gave a big blow to the lobotomists around the world, working with Congress, working with feminist groups, working with people concerned about the racism of little black kids being operated on and so on. And then later start taking on the shock doctors, the pharmaceutical industry. I found that even though these were huge threats, realistic threats, at one point threat to my medical license, at another point threats to my life, I found out that it was really still the childhood guilt, shame, and anxiety that would disable me and make me back off. And that once I began to handle the guilt, shame, and anxiety better, I realized that I was liberated to do the things I believed without becoming emotionally overwhelmed by seemingly terrible threats. Well, they weren't so terrible once I dealt with the underlying helplessness from childhood. I really want to tell you that. And I still do a lot of reform work. And it's without the emotional toll of when I was younger and hadn't dealt with the guilt, shame, and anxiety. So what I want to say to you is that you'll lose nothing by giving up your guilt, shame, and anxiety. Even if you think the world would be better off if somebody in jail felt guilty or ashamed or anxious, even if you think somebody else's children need to feel guilt, shame, or anxiety, which I don't agree with, you don't need to feel it. You can tell yourself, I'm going to give up guilt and shame and anxiety, and I'm going to be a better person. I'm going to think about what's good for my neighbors, what's good for my wife or husband and children or partner, what's good for other people, what do I want to do that's exciting and wonderful and interesting and valuable to people. Let me talk for a couple of minutes about what love is. The first part of my book is about the theory of negative legacy emotions. It's about biological evolution, why we develop these, how we can identify them and overcome them. That becomes more the second part of the book, identifying them and overcoming them. And the third part of the book is freedom to love. Okay, well, let me think a minute. Before going on to the freedom to love, I want to talk about what I brought up, the three steps to emotional freedom. The first step is identifying guilt, shame, anxiety, and chronic anger and numbness, identifying them. The second step is really approaching them with a conviction that they have no place in your life, no more place than the weeds in your garden, if you're a gardener. No more place than the rocks in your driveway. That these don't have a place in your life. So you identify them, you decide they don't have a place, and then you work on replacing them with principled living and love. And you actually practice it. You can actually practice sitting quietly, for example, and I give some examples how to practice it, but one thing you could do, for example, that I did when I was young and I found and I found that I was very anxious out in nature in the quiet of an evening by a lake, practice sitting quietly and telling yourself, I want to feel loving toward the world around me. Toward my room, toward the sky, toward God, toward my wife, my children, my husband, you know, loving toward anything, anyone. And then each time guilt, shame, and anxiety get in the way, tell them you want them to leave and get back to experiencing a rational state of loving. This is the key to life, a rational and loving state. So what's love? How do you identify love? I've had a simple definition of love that I've used through many books and through much of my life, and that is that love is joyful awareness. Joyful awareness. If I look out on a sunset over our lake, it makes me feel happy. It's beautiful. It makes me feel happy. Joyful. If I look at Gingy and I look at her face, man, I have to be really out of it not to really feel joyful and set aside all the junk and the garbage, the guilt, the shame, the anxiety, the chronic anger, the numbness, and just look at her and remind myself emotionally, spiritually, even physically that I feel loving toward this person and she's looking back at me with love. Dogs, I think that dogs may have helped us through evolution with their unconditional love. They may have helped us understand unconditional love. When you love your puppy, it's joyful. When you love your old dog, it's joyful. Now, relationship is what makes for the pain. And most of the pain in relationship is when guilt, shame, and anxiety, chronic anger, and numbness get in the way of our loving. Because we've all been injured in love. Starting early in childhood, there are injuries. Even if our parents were ideal, which is hard to imagine how a human being could be ideal given human nature and how conflicted it is with all of the problems I'm talking about. But even if you had a relatively good childhood, you were hurt in love in some way or another. You spent time alone. When you felt rejected, you reached out and were rejected by someone in your teens, maybe again and again. Most of us have a lot of painful experiences in love, in loving, caring relationships, betrayals, and friendship. If you become more public figure, you're going to have lots of betrayals from people who use you and then disappear when they think it's better. But you'll also have wonderful experiences where when the going gets tough, lots of people come to your support. Then that's wonderful. So love is joyful feeling, joyful relating. The darker side is all the negative legacy emotions, well as the traumas that we go through that stimulate them. Because betrayal stimulates shame, stimulates guilt, stimulates anxiety, stimulates chronic anger, stimulates numbness. But the more you handle those emotions, the more easily you'll get past the betrayals, the losses, the injuries, the illnesses, even the physical illnesses, even brain injury, if we can get in touch with that loving, rational core, we can surmount them, we can overcome them. I talk about sexual dysfunction as spiritual dysfunction. Unless you've been taking psychiatric drugs or something else that just really impaired your physiologic functioning, most sexual dysfunction is spiritual in nature and psychological and comes from guilt, shame, and anxiety because it's the most intimate relationship. So since we're inherently so violent, remember that early point I made, and since we're so inherently desirous of intimacy and love and closeness, well then, sexual relationships just become a place for all of our best and worst impulses to play out. And we have to be really in touch and really loving to make the most of a sexual relationship. And I can tell you, as you grow older, love will change in its quality, but you'll still just get such physical pleasure out of being near to or touching your loved one, because sex and love come together and stay together in close relationships. So, and even if you've got a physical dysfunction, like you've been on SSRIs for years and you're withdrawing from them and you're trying to recover, don't forget my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, for those of you who are struggling with drugs. But as you come off of them, your spiritual strength will help you surmount your painful emotions. And in my practice, you know, I help people who have been really badly injured in regard to their brain function so that it shows up on neuropsychiatric testing. It shows up in clinical evaluation, shows up in how they can handle things in their life. They still go on to better lives than ever, than before the injury, when they learn more and more to let go of guilt, shame, and anxiety, chronic anger, numbness, and to live by principles, sound principles, based on empathy and caring, and to become what I call a source of love. It's a key to life is to become a source of love. A part of all of this is moving toward living by higher purposes. It's another concept. In that regard, I want to return to Charles Darwin. Because when I really began to reread Darwin, and in particular his book, The Descent of Man, I realized that even the people writing the introductions to the book for various volumes were not telling the truth about what's in the book. Again and again in The Descent of Man, dozens of times, Darwin talks about love. He talks about the golden rule on several occasions. He talks about how love, as human beings know it, is beyond their instincts. It's something we develop through culture and knowledge and what he calls habit or learning and hard work. And in fact, he only mentions survival of the fittest 3 times in The Descent of Man, compared to, I think it was 60 or more times he mentions love. And beyond that, he mentions sympathy, and they don't have the word empathy. He talks about sympathy and the social instincts and the social development culture. I mean, there are hundreds of references to these positive social qualities, and only 3 to survival of the fittest. And one of them, those 3 mentions, is to explain why he's re-edited his earlier book on the origin of species to remove so much emphasis on survival of the fittest. Well, you don't get that from reading any of the new Darwinists. Darwin was actually the first humanistic psychologist, as far as I can tell, and I have a whole appendix about that because I didn't want to interrupt the flow of the book talking too much about Darwin. But I have an appendix on how Darwin was not a Darwinist. I also have an appendix on why you don't want to take psychiatric drugs to try to handle your biologically and childhood-shaped guilt, shame, and anxiety, because they're just going to diminish your ability to handle your emotions, your ability to identify them, to know them, to feel them, and to move beyond your negative emotions toward love, toward creativity, toward courage, and all the positive things. So Darwin wasn't a Darwinist. Darwin was a humanistic psychologist and an evolutionary biologist. And I really got to realize this after I was already involved in the writing of the book, so far along that Stanley Krippner, the marvelous humanistic psychologist, he's an award winner in 2013 for Humanist of the Year, from the division, that division in APA. Stanley Krippner was very, very generously writing and a foreword to the book. I was that far along when he pointed out that Darwin wasn't a Darwinist in the foreword. And he and I corresponded about it. And I went ahead and I read some reading that he had directed me toward. And I realized that everything I was saying in the book was consistent with Darwin. I had no idea. And so I was able to go back and rephrase a few things and then to put in the appendix that everything I'm saying was consistent with who may very well be among the very first humanistic psychologists talking about our overcoming our biological givens, about our becoming human beings who can surmount their guilt, their shame, and their anxiety. He doesn't use those words, but he does talk about overcoming primitive instinctual emotions and points out how malleable they are in the hands of us human beings. So I'm going to finish up now. I had planned to talk about my book this early, but I was left without a guest today, and it's just led to this happy conclusion of, well, what can I just freely talk about with ease for an hour? And it's my new book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. The subtitle is Understanding and Overcoming Your Emotions. You can get it in advance now on Amazon.com. I hope you've enjoyed my talk about this. I hope you've gotten some guidance from it and some inspiration. I want to be spending more of my time on that in future years, without letting go of my critique of the psychopharmaceutical complex of drugs. Thank you for listening.